Today on Against the Grain, the groundswell of opposition to Trump's deportation agenda has been astounding.
These draconian policies are affecting people's lives in really detrimental ways, that we might miss the fact that people have always been organizing. For as long as the United States has been deporting people, people have been organizing and trying to find ways to remain.
Historian Adam Goodman discusses the struggles mounted by immigrant workers in the 1970s, the 2006 May Day immigrant workers' general strike, and the necessity of organizing lasting movements for change. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The Trump administration has put deporting immigrants at the center of his presidency and witnessed the explosion of a mass movement against it. Adam Goodman teaches history and Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois Chicago and is the author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. Adam, when I spoke to you a few months into Trump's second term, you said that as a scholar of immigration and deportation, that even you were surprised that Trump had put deportations at the absolute center of his domestic policy. He, of course, campaigned on a platform of deporting immigrants with criminal records. But what the country has gotten has been orders of magnitude more extreme, as well as widespread. A year later, do you have a sense of why this has been so central to Trump's strategy?
Well, first and foremost, it's helped Trump gain power and maintain power and, you know, exercise an incredible amount of authority over, as we've seen, non-citizens and citizens alike. You know, this is about immigration in name, but it's really a means to an end. And, you know, Trump's own, personal interests and political interests are very clearly at the center of the immigration enforcement operations we've seen recently, but even in his first term as well. And I think that, you know, he and many members of the administration, namely people like Stephen Miller, and now, you know, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, among others, you know, have recognized this as an issue in which they, you know, are able to divert attention from things that might not be polling well back to immigrants as, you know, a catch-all category for all that's wrong in the country. And, you know, they've strategically used immigrants and non-citizens, the so-called other, which we can't really separate, obviously, from the rest of the nation. But, you know, if you just follow the rhetoric coming out of the White House, you know, you would think it would be easy. It's not, of course. But they've used them, you know, for their own strategic gains instead of developing a more robust social safety net or social welfare state to support people and the real needs they have. And I think that's in part the reason why the strategy of scapegoating immigrants has been so effective, because people have real needs and people are struggling across the country. And, you know, that's why it resonates. And that's incredibly troubling, but it's not that surprising.
You write in your book, The Deportation Machine, that the forcing out of immigrants has been really an enduring feature of the U.S. state in U.S. history, especially since the 19th century. Can you give us an idea of the magnitude of that effort over much of U.S. history?
One of the surprising things I realized when I embarked on the research for my book was that more than 60 million people at this point, 60 million people have been deported from the United States. That's a shocking figure. I don't think many people are aware of that. And they're also not aware of the fact that, you know, these deportations started in the late 19th century when the federal government gained control over immigration and who was allowed to enter the country, who was allowed to remain. And there were certain moments throughout U.S. history, say in the late 19th century, the focus on Chinese labor migrants who are seen as a threat economically and culturally and racially, or in the early 20th century, Southern and Eastern Europeans, you know, who were targeted for exclusion and for restriction or maybe it was political radicals around the same time in the 19 teens or heading into the middle of the 20th century with the McCarthy era. And then throughout most of the 20th century, Mexican labor migrants and Mexicans seeking to reunite with their families as well, who are in the United States. And so, the net has been cast wide. It's targeted different people at different times for different reasons. And we've also seen a real increase in the number of deportations as the avenues for legal migration to the United States closed, but the United States continued to rely on immigrant labor. And unsurprisingly, people continued to want to be with their families who are split across borders. So changes in policy across the 20th century made it more difficult for people to come to the country with authorization and led to an increase in the so-called undocumented population, and in turn, a crackdown from immigration authorities. So this story does not start with the election of Donald Trump in 2016, or even, for that matter, in the late 20th century. But there have been important moments of change over time. There have been an increasing number of deportations in the last 50 or 60 years. And I think that this is, a story that, we need to understand kind of, and it also helps us situate the present moment and what's happening and both what's perhaps part of a longer tradition as well as what's new.
Well, how would you understand that acceleration, I guess, of a long-standing feature of the US state, of both economic reliance as a country on immigrant labor and yet perennial forcing out of people? Why did this intensify over the last 50 years?
There's a real turning point in the 1960s, heading into the 1970s, when a couple of things happen. Number one is that the 1965 Immigration Act, which was seen within kind of the guise of civil rights era policies signed into law by Lyndon Johnson, at the base of the Statue of Liberty, in the harbor there, and there's compelling photographs of that day you can find easily, your listeners can find easily online. But this law is remembered for ending the national origin quota system, which was a discriminatory practice signed into law 4 decades earlier in 1924, which limited people coming from the United States, especially from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as from most of Asia. And this law was seen as this liberal measure that ended discriminatory policy. But what it also did, and which scholars have increasingly recognized and focused on, is for the first time, it put a cap or a limit on immigration from the Western Hemisphere, including from Mexico. Mexico historically had been the source of labor migration, largely because the United States had closed off avenues for labor migrants from other parts of the world to come here. And because of that, and because of the geographic proximity, and because over time, again, Mexicans had established roots in large parts of the United States, which used to be Mexico until 1848, when the United States took, roughly half of Mexico's territory through war and conquest. And after that, we see that there are large numbers of Mexicans who are divided across borders. And as their labor is needed, but the avenues to come, have been closed off largely, people needed to come through other measures. So that change in law and the cap on Western Hemisphere immigration, along with an amendment which was put into place around a decade later, which said that regardless of which country people are coming from, we're going to give a per country quota of 20,000 migrants per year, to everywhere from Mexico to Andorra or Luxembourg or Australia. Which made no sense. It made sense perhaps within the guise of the civil rights policies of equality, but we've learned since it really makes no sense given both the geographic proximity as well as the historical relationship and the labor history between the United States and Mexico. That was a real problem. And the second thing that happened right at the same time was that in December 31st, 1964, the Bracero program expired. The Bracero program was a 22-year program that brought temporary Mexican guest workers to the United States on short-term contracts, largely in agriculture and some other industries as well. And over the course of that time period, many industries and employers came to rely on those Mexican migrants for their labor. And people also, you know, set down roots in the United States during that time. And after the Bracero program ended, their labor was needed, but they no longer had the legal means to come. And that, combined with the 1965 Act's change and the cap on Western Hemisphere, meant that Mexicans were needed in the country. Mexicans wanted to come to the country because they had established roots over the course of years, decades, even generations, but they no longer had the legal means to do so. And so, you know, that's largely why we see the growth, significant growth of the population considered undocumented, as well as on the crackdown in the decades since. And it became almost a foregone conclusion that as the undocumented population increased, the immigration service then could submit larger and larger congressional budget appropriation requests in hopes of solving the problem, which was a creation of the change in policy to begin with. And it kind of spiraled out of control in the decades since.
The U.S. state has historically used three ways to drive out immigrants. And at different times, different ways have predominated. One is through the formal mechanisms of the state. One is through so-called voluntary departures. And then finally, the third is based on campaigns of fear, leading immigrants to flee the country before being deported. Can you describe for us those three methods and how they've ebbed and flowed?
Of course. And you know, this is something that I also came to realize throughout the course of researching and writing the book, is that most people don't really understand what deportation looks like in practice. I think there's an idea that we might have of immigrants being apprehended by an agent and having their day in court, being able to explain the circumstances and plead their case. And then based on the merits, the judge would decide whether or not they're able to stay or whether they had to go. But that, in fact, is hardly ever how deportation plays out. And this, in part, has to do with the state's reliance on creative means to augment their authority and their discretionary power. And so the mechanisms that I uncovered, which I trace throughout the course of the last century and a half, and we've seen kind of at play today as well, as you mentioned, depend on both formal mechanisms of expulsion, but also these informal mechanisms, which actually are how, you know, 85 or 90% of deportations throughout U.S. history have taken place. So the formal deportations, which happen sometimes, although increasingly not so much, by order of an immigration judge, are just a small fraction, again, a sliver, really, of the total. More commonly, what would happen is that after being apprehended, agents would provide immigrants with really a slate of bad options, and they had to choose the least bad of all those options, which oftentimes was voluntary departure, as you said. And just to be clear, this happens after apprehension, so there's nothing voluntary about it. But people are facing the threat of extended detention stays for who knows how long. They're facing the threat of being barred from the country if formally deported. And so they agree to accept voluntary departure under duress, essentially, and to leave the country to both avoid long detention stays as well as open up the possibility, potentially, not guaranteed, but potentially, of being able to return to the country in the future. And so what I look into this practice too in the book is kind of the role that plea bargains play in the criminal justice system. You know, most cases actually never make it to trial because there's a plea bargain struck, in part because people are threatened with such harsh penalties or sentences that they agree to a lesser penalty, even if they could stand a chance to win their case in court. And so most immigrants never have their day in court. It's just the workings and kind of machinations of the immigration bureaucracy and low-level agents of the state who exert extraordinary discretionary power over the lives of migrants that result in their deportation. You know, the third mechanism you mentioned, and the kind of self-deportations in response to fear campaigns and terror, which I think we've seen recently certainly during the second Trump administration, has become front and center of an important part of the overall operations, which they've ratcheted up to perhaps previously unknown levels. And in fact, there are now these slick videos, which people may have seen online on social media, or perhaps you receive email notifications as well, since the Department of Homeland Security is spending a lot of money in advertising these self-deportation drives and offering financial incentives even for migrants to leave. But there's a long history to this practice. And again, it's a way, in a sense, it's a way that the state is recognizing the limits of its power to apprehend and deport everyone that it would like to, but in fact, trying to exceed those limits through this means by making people's lives so miserable that they decide to pick up and leave. And I should say that we have seen that this has worked in recent months and during the past year since Trump returned to office. But the majority of people, both now as well as in the past, have not left the country in response to these campaigns. The majority have stayed, and I think that's worth emphasizing.
Well, it's often observed in left circles that, speaking of kind of the limits of what any state apparatus seems able to do, that Trump, in his ham-fisted way, has deported fewer people than Obama managed to do. And of course, we shouldn't forget the enormous numbers of people deported under the Democrats, under Obama, under Biden. But since those numbers, I believe, are drawn from the so-called voluntary deportations, the semi-formal deportations of the state, doesn't this risk missing the large numbers of people or significant numbers of people who have left preemptively in this climate of extreme fear, even if the majority of people have managed to stay? The climate of fear is so intense that many people have left.
That's 100% true. And I think you raise an important point here. And we should be cognizant of kind of the politics of immigration statistics and the numbers we hear thrown around. And we should kind of dig a little bit deeper and interrogate what they actually mean. One point that I want to emphasize as well is that what it means to be deported and the consequences of being deported have changed over time. Today, the consequences of being deported are harsher than they ever have been in the past. The border is more militarized than it ever has been before. Because of the administration's policies today, it would be harder for someone to return to the country if they're removed. In the past, that wasn't necessarily the case. People are spending more time in detention today. More people are being detained today than they had in the past. So deportation itself, what it looks like and what it implies, has changed over time, which I want to stress. Another point you bring up in terms of kind of who deported the most people is both a useful metric, but it can be misleading as well because of who the people were. And not to say that some are more justifiable than others necessarily, but the consequences on individuals and what it means for individuals, families, and communities is different. So Trump may not have deported as many people during his first year of the second term as, say, Bill Clinton and some of his time in office, or George W. Bush, et cetera, Barack Obama. But who's deported has changed dramatically. Now we have far fewer people who are apprehended at the border and deported quickly after trying to enter the country. We have a much larger presence of interior enforcement, people that have deep roots here in the United States, whose families are here, who have been here in some cases for generations, and many of them in mixed status families. So US citizens, permanent residents, et cetera, are affected by these campaigns as well. But that's who has been apprehended and deported more than anyone else during this first year of the second Trump administration. And that's something that has shifted. It's not to say that interior enforcement didn't exist before. It did. And in fact, in the 1970s, I uncovered that large numbers of people, more than 100,000 people in some years from the interior, were apprehended and deported, which I think hadn't been known prior to the research that I did for the book. But what we're seeing today is of a different scale, and the consequences for people across the country are different than they have been in the past.
Historian Adam Goodman is my guest. He is the author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So, Adam, immigrants are often portrayed as pretty helpless victims of the state's repression. But you argue in The Deportation Machine that immigrants have a long history of fighting back. And I wonder if you could describe the immigrants' rights movement that emerged in the 1970s at the start of what you describe as this era of mass expulsion. In what context did it emerge, and with whom did immigrants ally themselves?
This is a really essential point, and I think we're so often focused on how horrible everything is and how these draconian policies are affecting people's lives in really detrimental ways that we might miss the fact that people have always been organizing. For as long as the United States has been deporting people, people have been organizing and trying to find ways to remain. And that's both, again, to stay with their families or to perhaps maintain the economic opportunities they have here, to continue to send money and support their family back at home, wherever they may be from. What emerges in the 1970s, what I like to think of kind of the birth of the modern day immigrant rights movement, comes out of a long history as well and trajectory of immigrants organizing. So in the late 19th century, early 20th century, when Chinese migrants are being targeted, you have groups of mutual aid organizations, like the Chinese Six Companies, who organized effectively to defend Chinese migrants in court. And there are several important Supreme Court cases, which led to and some people being able to remain in the country and carved out some rights for immigrants. In the 19-teens and 20s, there were civil liberties advocates, pushing for, the protections for people like Emma Goldman and other political radicals, who were facing immigration enforcement and imminent deportation. And from the 1930s to the 1950s, you had groups like the American Committee for the Protection of the Foreign-Born, which emerges out of the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, to protect political radicals and labor organizers. I wrote an article about that organization and a particular Mexican migrant here in Chicago who was targeted, Rodolfo Lozoya, which I published in the journal Labor, which should be available online. But they're the really powerful stories of immigrants and allies coming together in the face of tremendous repression, such that by the 1970s, coming out of the civil rights era, coming out of the Chicano movement, and because of this changes in immigration that I described earlier in our conversation in terms of the growing undocumented population in response to the policy shifts. And all of that kind of coalesced around a series of individuals and organizations across the country forming mutual aid networks, as well as launching defensive and offensive efforts to protect immigrants and to guarantee their ability to stay in the country. So you have people taking to the streets in large numbers, mass marches, calling attention to the plight that people are facing, or particular cases that might have generated a lot of publicity. You also have lawyers defending people. You have labor organizers who are very interested in the growing undocumented population and trying to bring them into the fold of their own labor unions and to grow labor and worker power. You have Know Your Rights campaigns. You have educational, political education efforts. And really it's the coalition of people that came together and fought on so many fronts, and in some cases won. And I think that's really important. In some cases won, that I want to stress.
So in your book, you tell the story of immigrant workers at Sabika Shoe Company in California who organized themselves. What happened there, and how did that struggle ultimately influence subsequent battles by immigrants?
So in mid-May 1978, early in the morning, around 8 o'clock, a group of around 40 immigration agents descended on the Sabika Shoe Company factory in South El Monte, in El Monte, in the San Gabriel Valley. to the east of Los Angeles. They surrounded the factory, and they went through and indiscriminately questioned everyone, all of the workers there, you know, almost all of whom were Mexican or Central American, you know, some Cuban as well. And just based on their appearance, apprehended, you know, around 120, or I think it was 119 people that morning. Took them on buses back to downtown Los Angeles to the INS office of the federal building, held them there. And by that same afternoon, around half the people were, you know, headed to the border for deportation through voluntary departure. That some had been tricked or coerced into agreeing to voluntary departure, and others had decided that they didn't want to spend any time in detention, you know, and accepted that offer. What most people didn't realize was that in the background, there was also an activist network, a coalition of people that sprang into action. And as a result, the buses never made it to the border that day. They turned around because there's a labor organizer at the factory who had been actively working to organize the workers. They had recently lost a closely contested election to form a union at the factory. And the labor organizer, Jesse Gonzalez, was out at the factory that day in front when the immigration agents arrived. He quickly sprang into action and called an immigration lawyer, called a colleague, who filed an injunction in federal court, and a judge stopped the workers' deportation. Now, this case ends up being incredibly consequential, in part because the organizers and the lawyers and the migrants themselves figured out a way to potentially bring the deportation machine to a grinding halt. They recognized a weak point in the machine and applied pressure to it, and that was that the machine depended on voluntary departures. It depended on people agreeing to leave without having their cases heard. And if everyone rejected voluntary departure, it would throw kind of sand in the gears of the machine, and it could potentially, you know, bring the whole system down. And the immigration agency and its lawyers were keenly aware of this. You know, editorials in the Wall Street Journal kind of made that clear, that there was a potential vulnerability here. Now, working together, the workers, the labor organizers, the lawyers, and others supporting them end up, you know, challenging the deportations of around 60 workers. And out of that group, many are able to stay in the country. They win their cases. The INS has to cease their efforts to deport them. The judge finds that, you know, there's no reason to deport them. They can't establish even where they're from. And these basic rights by just maintaining silence, kind of, you know, these basic constitutional rights that undocumented people have just as citizens have. And they're able to win their cases. And, you know, that was an incredibly empowering moment. But the other thing that happened was that they filed a class action lawsuit. So if the defense of individual migrants was part of this strategy, another part was more an offensive move to file class action lawsuit in which the Immigration Service would be required to provide migrants with Miranda-style rights, advising them of their basic rights when they encounter them and when they apprehend them. That took 14 years, but by 1992, you know, they won that case, and that led to tremendous victory for the migrants and the organizers, but also the many more people affected by it. So it was a small group of around 60 migrants that day who ended up trying to fight their cases. And it led to protections potentially for more than a million people. And I think that's an important reminder, both that, you know, the sustained struggle over a long period of time mattered a great deal, but so did the broad coalition of people involved in that fight.
Speaking of those coalitions, so you write that along with the immigrants themselves, who are absolutely central to these struggles, that they were able to find allies who had not necessarily been focused on the struggles of undocumented workers before then, including unions. Why did unions, or some unions, in the 1970s start taking seriously or taking up the struggle of such workers when they had historically excluded them from their unions?
It's an important question, and I think it speaks to the fact of the composition of the U.S. labor force was changing. You know, there were more undocumented workers, more people, you know, working without legal authorization or status. And some unions and some industries, you know, saw recruiting people, regardless of their legal status, as essential to their own survival. And so, as you say, you know, this didn't happen kind of across the board. It's not as if all unions, you know, welcomed undocumented workers with open arms. And there is a long kind of contentious history to the relationship between organized labor and undocumented workers. But more and more unions, like the International Ladies Garment Workers Union and others, saw their futures being directly tied to trying to organize undocumented workers along with people, you know, here in the United States with authorization. And so that shift happened around that time, just as this movement was coalescing. And unions came to be, some unions, I should say, you know, came to be an essential part of these broader diverse coalitions that defended migrants.
Adam Goodman is my guest. He's the author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. He is Associate Professor of History and Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of Illinois, Chicago. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So while there were various groups that were formed in this period that you're talking about, kind of a pivotal moment, really, to fight for immigrant rights, one of the most notable and left was an organization called CASA, which translates to the Center for Autonomous Social Action, General Brotherhood of Workers. Who were they and what did they fight for?
Well, CASA was made up of a diverse coalition of mostly, you know, Mexican but Latino workers and labor organizers who fought for people regardless of their immigration status, regardless of where they're from. You know, Sin Fronteras was the name of their publication, their newspaper, you know, Without Borders. And, you know, CASA led the struggle in many cases for undocumented people and for migrants, and tried to form bridges between undocumented migrants and ethnic Mexicans and other Latinos who had perhaps lived in the United States for years or decades or even generations. You know, there's a contentious history among the Latino community or among ethnic Mexicans in particular, in which some people, you know, weren't in favor of supporting ongoing immigration from Mexico. They saw that as potentially a threat to themselves. And there's a long history to that, which, you know, the best book that I'd recommend to people is an extraordinary text by the historian David Gutierrez called Walls and Mirrors, which examines this history in depth, as well as the shifting alliances. And Gutierrez traces CASA's history toward the end of the book. And this is something that I pick up on as well, because this was an organization that I think was ahead of its time in many ways, but also marked this crucial turning point that we just discussed in relation to the changing ways in which organizations were seeing undocumented people, and also recognizing the fact that the undocumented immigrants were becoming a larger presence in the country and a more permanent presence in the country. And as borders hardened for the remainder of the 20th century, increasingly so, it became more difficult for people to go back and forth from Mexico. That also led to more people deciding to stay in the United States, and in turn resulted in, you know, a growing undocumented population. So CASA is an incredible group. Their papers, if anyone's interested, are actually in the Bay Area at Stanford University's Special Collections and Archives, and they're open for, you know, consultation. But there's really a tremendous history there that I think, you know, we need to know much more about.
How did the movements that you've been describing evolve from the 1970s, you know, at the start of this era of mass deportation, over the subsequent decades where the demonization of immigrants increased, the border was increasingly militarized, including the very significant passage signed by Bill Clinton of the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act? So these tough on crime politics just intensifying the terrain that people were organizing. And yet, when we think of those decades, you know, they did culminate in May Day 2006, the immigrant workers' general strike, called the first general strike of our recent era.
So there's always a give and take between, the policies that are on the books, and, the more punitive, the harsher they are, more draconian than the policies are, and the higher the likelihood that people are going to organize in response. And in some cases, that'll be in a single moment. But also there, in many cases, both organizations or institutions that persist and that are able to continue on. But I don't want to give you the sense that, immigration organizing was always kind of at, high levels across the last 50 years. But there have been particular moments. And, certainly coming out of the 1970s into the 1980s, keeping the pressure up. And again, one of the real lessons here is the importance of sustained struggle and keeping up the pressure as much as possible, which is very difficult to do, but essential to bringing about political change, because there's many instances in which moments arise, and you need to be able to capitalize on them. So in 1986, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, for example, which led to the legalization of, as many as 3 million immigrants in the country, that in part was because there had been, kind of consistent pressure and advocacy and organizing. And in response to that, many people were upset, perhaps because they felt threatened by the growing immigrant population, the changing composition of the country, and also because individual politicians, saw, again, immigrants as easy scapegoats, for their own political gain. In response to that, there's a series of draconian policies and really harsh policies implemented at the state level in places like California. We can think here of Proposition 187 in the 1990s, with Governor Pete Wilson championing that policy, which would have stripped away kind of basic rights and protections and support system or social safety net for immigrants without authorization. Or later on in 2005, the Sensenbrenner bill, coming out of those 1990s policies that President Bill Clinton, the Democrat, signed into law. You have the Sensenbrenner bill, which is really Proposition 187 on a national level. And in response to that, people across the country came out in really unprecedented numbers at that time, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people cumulatively in cities across the country and also small towns came out and organized those May Day 2006 marches and protests, which I vividly remember. And actually, in part, is the reason I do what I do. I was curious about what was going on, and really, I think, taken by the fact that people were coming out and standing up for themselves, regardless of their immigration status. And that I think led to sustained organizing in the years and decades ahead, especially around young undocumented activists that would start kind of the Dreamer movement and the Undocumented and Unafraid movement, which I'd also be happy to talk about.
Yeah, can you remind our listeners about how they organize themselves?
So in the 2000s, young undocumented people who were brought to the country as children by their parents and who remained without status, despite the fact that they had lived here most of their lives, in some cases, since they were just babies or young children, elementary school age children, and were American in every sense of the word except for the piece of paper to prove their citizenship. They organized and pushed for a pathway to legalization and a pathway to citizenship for themselves. This became known as the Dreamer kind of movement, and the students or the young undocumented people were known as Dreamers. That was an acronym. I think the acronym is Development, Relief, and Education of Alien Minors. And I don't think everyone's aware of that. The alien there kind of sets off alarm bells for people. And I think it's in part the reason why, increasingly over time, the people that, advocated as a part of that movement, came to drop the Dreamer label. And I actually know many young people that reject it actively, and see it as not reflecting themselves, or their families or the struggles that they want to be a part of. But this became really kind of a potent political organizing tool in which young people would kind of don cap and gowns and play to tropes of the so-called good immigrant, in hopes of, getting broad-based support from, the American public that may not have known much about, immigration as a policy issue, in hopes of pushing, U.S. politicians to, adopt and to pass, the DREAM Act, which never passed, has failed time and again, for more than 2 decades at this point. And the other important thing to flag here is that over time, as I alluded to, people realized that in advocating for themselves as young undocumented people, there came an implicit point, which some commentators in the media and some politicians would note, in that they were at no fault, but implicitly their parents were at fault. And so the parents of these young people became demonized. And over time, what ends up happening is that people move from advocating for young people who fit certain criteria. They were either needed to be in, you know, in school or needed to be serving the military. So it was really restrictive and conservative in some ways. They moved from that to advocating for what they called protection for all. I think that was a key shift, you know, that took place around, you know, 2010, 2012, after Congress had failed again and again to pass the DREAM Act. And eventually what happens is that these young organizers and activists, because the being able to keep the pressure up, they pushed the Obama administration to implement DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, an imperfect program, but an important one that provides temporary protections, you know, for young undocumented people who meet certain criteria. And that's something that people, you know, continue to benefit from today, even though it's, you know, been on the chopping block, you know, for at least the last 10 years.
I'm speaking with historian Adam Goodman, author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So in the time that we have left, Adam, I wanted to turn to the present. The earliest and really most powerful resistance that we saw to Trump's second administration came from immigrants and their communities, you know, including in the early months when powerful legal firms, universities, the mainstream media, and other institutions were accommodating themselves to Trump, and there hadn't really been mass protests at that point. We saw immigrants around the country, including people in isolated rural areas, militantly pushing back against ICE. And I wonder if you could describe how people started resisting, started organizing themselves, which of course snowballed as Trump sent large numbers of ICE agents into various predominantly democratically controlled cities.
It's really helpful to have a common enemy. And, you know, Trump and the Trump administration has certainly, you know, served that purpose when it comes to immigration. So, you know, people that are out in the streets now and really brave, incredible ways, probably weren't out in the streets, you know, during the Biden administration. And it's not to say that things are the same. They've changed dramatically. But things for immigrants weren't great during the Biden administration either in many ways. So the fact that there is this common enemy and the fact that Trump has made immigration the number one issue and tried to keep it front and center, and the unprecedented crackdown, really, when it comes to sending federal agents into cities and towns across the country, and not just ICE, but also, you know, Border Patrol officers, as well as, you know, other federal agents from different agencies, which they have repurposed for immigration enforcement. And that hasn't happened in the past to the extent that we've seen recently. And that's overwhelming. That's depressing. I think it's you know, incredibly troubling for so many people. The situation is dire. At the same time, I think we should be inspired by the fact that if people are out in the streets and they are active in their communities, you know, organizing in, you know, mutual aid networks and ICE watches, and really, you know, coming to defend, if not themselves and their families, then their neighbors and the other people that, you know, make up essential parts of their communities. And that's something that is, I think, really admirable, something that presents tremendous possibilities and potential. And the question becomes how to maintain that energy and maintain these networks over time, because chances are that, you know, the defensive measures that people have taken, and that's been foremost on people's minds, given the crackdowns that are happening across the country. But we need to also think about how to maintain these networks, you know, beyond the present moment when the frenzy has passed, but things for immigrants, you know, remain challenging at best.
I believe that now 38 people have died in ICE detention centers since Trump's second term started. What do we know of the resistance that's taken place within ICE detention centers, staying with the immigrants themselves, organizing, resisting, such as the one in Dilley, Texas, where Liam Conejo Ramos, the pre-kindergartner who was arrested in Minnesota in his bunny hat, was taken?
Organizing in detention, is something that has taken place in the past. The journalist Seth Fried Wessler has reported on this for the New York Times Magazine. And there are examples of immigrants undertaking hunger strikes or media campaigns or, really getting the word out in any way they can and making, sacrifices and putting themselves and their well-being at risk to try to bring about, change to the policies that are inhumane, that are deadly, as you mentioned. Immigration detention is a product of a certain number of policy decisions made by people, that have the interests oftentimes of shareholders and, their voting blocks in mind. So the Trump administration made clear upon returning to power that they were going to expand immigration detention. We actually saw during the early days of the pandemic, 2020, 2021, that immigration detention dropped dramatically, in part because of the challenge of confining people in closed spaces, the potential spread of communicable diseases. But we saw that, the immigration detention capacity, which I think was around 36 to 44,000 in those days of the Biden administration, dropped to, 14,000 or 19,000. It was more than cut in half. What we've seen since then is that there are now as many as 70,000 people held in immigration detention. And in part, this relates to what we discussed earlier in terms of the pressures put on people to try to get them to agree to voluntary departure or to try to get them to agree to leave the country and to drop their cases and their efforts to remain in the United States. And by making immigration detention so miserable, it speaks to this real toxic confluence of profits and punishment that have had physical, psychological, material costs for people. And, as again, to reiterate, have been deadly. And that's something that doesn't have to be that way. Different policy decisions could lead us in a different direction. There's no reason why people need to be locked up who are just trying to remain in the country to be with their families or to continue with their employment or whatever it might be. And, that's something that in my mind is inexcusable.
The question of immigration has shifted in terms of public opinion around immigration. There's been a really remarkable drop statistically in terms of the associations of much of the public of immigration with these brutalized images and the shooting of U.S. citizens and so on, that in terms of something that had been one of Trump's leading issues, it's now tainted by all of this violence. And people are organizing and people are calling for ICE to be abolished, keeping in mind what you said about thinking about how to organize, not just in the white heat of this moment, or I should say the freezing cold for many people who are out there in the streets. What sorts of organizing do you think makes the most sense looking to the future? What kinds of changes would be necessary to shift these dynamics that have been in play, well, for centuries, but intensely so for the last half century?
I think this points to this broad question, which certainly applies to this issue, but to many others as well. And that's, how does political change happen? Who's involved in bringing it about, or who should be involved in bringing it about? And I think, history teaches us, certainly when it comes to questions of immigration, that we need large coalitions of people engaged in sustained struggle, keeping the pressure up so they can capitalize when the opportunities, usually surprisingly, present themselves. And we need people in the streets. We need people organizing on the local level, kind of the most concrete ways, defending themselves and their their neighbors. I think that, you know, we've seen that so effective in Minnesota, certainly here in Chicago. You know, these ice watches that have organized, the different ways in which people have, you know, really, you know, taken great risks and, you know, stood up for the people that matter most to them on a local level. And that's been incredibly effective. But we also need kind of top-down leadership from politicians, elected officials, you know, those in power, you know, to advocate for bold policies that don't necessarily just follow whatever the public opinion polls are saying. You know, and here I'm really looking to the Democrats who, you know, largely have done that in recent years and decades. And I think that's, you know, led them astray in many ways. But developing a set of, you know, core values and ideas about immigration and about the type of policies we should have that benefit, you know, immigrants and citizens alike, I think that's what we need. We need kind of bottom up, top down. We need really kind of all hands on deck and pressure from all sides. And that's what's going to bring about broader, you know, transformative changes. Now, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I think it would be misleading to say that it will. But there are many instances throughout history where transformative victories have been won, surprising all involved in pushing for them. And that's something that's important to remember as well. On an individual level, you know, people can both get involved in pre-existing networks and organizations that exist in their communities. You know, chances are, in most places across the United States, you know, people have been organizing around this issue, in some cases for a long time. So see what people are already doing, because I do think that there's, you know, a cost to holding out only when we get the radical changes that we'd like to see. And if those incremental changes in the meantime, while we continue to push for these broader transformations, can happen, then we should try to push for them and bring them about. You know, they benefit real people in the short term. It doesn't need to be an either or a binary between more incremental change and more radical change. It should be kind of a both and.
Adam Goodman, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Sasha.
Adam Goodman is Associate Professor of History and Latin American and Latino Studies at the University of Illinois Chicago. He is the author of The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.